This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I'll be talking to Brian Zanisnik, an artist working in sculpture, performance, video, and photography who lives in the Catskill Mountains. Brian received an MFA from Hunter College and attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. His work has been widely featured in the New York Times, National Public Radio, Art in America, Art Forum, Art News, and New York Magazine. Zanisnik has been the subject of 4 documentaries produced by Art 21, the most recent of which is titled Brian Zanisnik's Big Pivot. So I'd like to start by talking about the environment that you currently call home. Your work is so place-based that my sense is that you always relate to the places you inhabit very reflectively. So I'm wondering if you can paint us a picture of the place where you live now and talk about what aspects of it have inspired your work of late.
Sure, and I wanted to say thank you for having me on today.
Thanks for being here.
I think that, you know, I was drawn to the Catskills. Previously, I was living in New York City, and also before that, in a few years, I spent living in Stockholm, Sweden. And I think that I kind of had reached a point where I was interested in not living in a city and seeing how that would both, that landscape and that environment would influence my work. And I was drawn to this part of the Catskills, Greene County in particular, because I thought it was some of the most rugged nature you could have and still be in a relative proximity to New York City. Of course, Ulster County and parts of the Hudson Valley have a lot of nature too. But one of the things I noticed about Greene County and particularly the part that I'm in, I would notice I would come up here in the winter and people would be driving around in snowmobiles. And I was drawn to that, this kind of real transition and change from New York City. I mentioned I also lived in Stockholm, Sweden for a bit. And they kind of have quite intense weather too, very cold, a lot of snow. But the city is so well kept, it's so Scandinavian, so modern, that everything just feels very comfortable still. You know, there's this word, I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, like hygge. I think that means cozy in Swedish. And like the city is very cozy. So even if you're having snow, you know, I remember they would close a street and they would push all the snow off the roofs and then open the street and clear the street. So you kind of just were very, it was very manicured and cleared and kind of contained. But I noticed up here that I would go back to a word I used earlier, it was rugged. And I kind of was looking for that, but I think at first kind of overwhelmed by that. And only now am I starting to really process what that landscape, especially that impact of snow in the winter, what that would have on my work.
So we are recording in the Prattsville Art Center, which the town of Prattsville, I think in, was it 2012? Underwent like this horrible, devastating flood, and it just wiped away a good portion of the town.
Right. Yeah, there were houses that were going down the main street that were just completely washed away from their foundation.
Yeah. So there's, I feel like it's rugged and it's also kind of volatile.
It's part of the, I would also say like, it's part of the kind of historical neglect of rural areas. Maybe over the past, 40, 50 years. And I know that like the area where I live, which is about 10 to 15 minutes from here, that in the 70s, a lot of the houses, people were just going around and burning down the houses, and they never found out who it was. And there's all these theories, but I think that, and the Catskills was kind of at that time, a lot of people moving away from it, a lot of tourism had stopped, so there was a lot of maybe neglect. There was just a lot of lack of resources, but also both the intense weather but also maybe that maybe because of some of these things like the natural disaster in Prattsville or the lack of maybe a lot of resources in the area, that a lot of the areas just went into kind of a neglect.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I wanted to ask you about a photo series that you're working on now that responds to your environment in the Catskills. So I'm wondering if you can say a bit about what that series is.
Sure. So, you know, I've always with my work been really drawn to materials and objects. As Miriam was saying at the beginning, I work in a lot of different mediums, photography, performance, sculpture. I work with painting as well. And I think that what kind of links all my works is like a materiality. And an very specific and object-based materiality. And most of the objects I've used throughout my practice have had some kind of personal relationship or significance. Some of my early work involved going back to my parents' home in New Jersey, and I needed to help them clean out their basement, and I would pull the objects out of the basement, bring them to my studio, use them in photographs, performances, or sculptures, and then kind of dispose of those objects. So it's kind of like the objects having one last life or existence before they're gotten recycled. And I eventually had cleaned out the entire basement of my parents' home. So that that project came to a conclusion at that point. And I like these parameters of where, like, I'm not always directing or controlling. Something external is setting up the framework. So the basement was full. The work begins, the basement's empty, the work concludes. When I came up here, I had purchased a home that required a lot of restoration and renovation. And there was and that home was built in an area where there was a farm about 200 years ago. And the farm is long gone, but a lot of their materials are still there. So I was really drawn to sort of mine both the materials that were in the woods, but also things that I was kind of pulling out of the home. So like in the renovation, kind of old building materials, things that I had found inside the walls, old lamps. And these objects were then combined with kind of what I was also doing on the land, which was basically gardening and kind of landscaping it. So there's kind of this sort of this work, their photos, there's kind of a cyclical narrative of objects and material, old objects from the land, old objects and decaying objects even from the home, combined with kind of things that I'm growing, whether it's vegetables, flowers, and these photographs, they're basically still lifes, but they're all staged in front of one window in the home, so they're kind of very much a series, a kind of almost, I wouldn't use the word repetitive, but kind of each photograph is related to the next, and they're essentially exhibited as one large installation.
Something that I like to do is to try to describe some of the work, and I'll also include links to your work in the show notes so that our listeners can take a look. So this series of images, each image has a caption at the top that's written in a kind of all caps serif font. So it's black text against a white background that's above the image. And I'm looking at one specifically that's called Catastrophe question mark. And the image is of a vase with red and purple flowers. And the vase is set on top of two books. And then flanking the little stack of books is a few stacks of coins. And there's this effect where it's very hard to tell what was actually photographed in three dimensions and what was added afterwards. And there's like, the shadows are very minimal. So it looks kind of 2D and 3D at the same time.
Yeah, I think that the work, it draws on a lot from painting and, of course, even though it's a photograph, from sculpture. So I think when you kind of describe this sort of, you know, hard to decode what's actually a literal photograph, what's been manipulated, I think that's kind of this idea that it's photography, but maybe not like purely photography. And to, you were describing also the format, right? Each one sort of has this large black text at the top. And then it's kind of against a white background. And I was thinking a lot about these decorative posters people have in their homes. Like, you would go into someone's kitchen and it would say live, laugh, love, or wine o'clock.
Right.
And it's these really cliche, mundane kind of content lists. Like, a lot of people have these in their homes. No one looks at them because everyone's familiar with them. So I was kind of thinking about that. That vernacular, and also going back to my time in Sweden, I was thinking also there's kind of in Sweden they have this, but in Sweden it's a little more, it's a little different, it's a little more austere. They'll have like a scientific print of a leaf, and then maybe the Latin text above it, and or of a mushroom, and but it's kind of almost the same thing without the sort of whimsical American Americana take on it. So I was sort of playing off that, but as you were describing, trying to make something where the narrative is much more enigmatic and you kind of don't know what you're looking at. And it's also maybe a little more sinister. And I think that's just my sense of humor. The one you were discussing with Catastrophe, question mark as a title. I think one of the books there is a famous mindfulness book titled... Full Catastrophe Living.
Okay.
So it's kind of like this photo where it's like, you know, full catastrophe living. It's like probably not something you're going to sit on the subway and read. It's a pretty intense title. But then you have it against like these beautiful flowers against this very kind of formal and very controlled backdrop. So there's kind of this weaving between something maybe sinister and against something kind of maybe just beautiful and calming. So I like the idea that these photos can kind of be in your kitchen. You could put them up in your, like, I could put it, I have six of them in my kitchen. So you can come in and be like, oh, look, they're calming and beautiful, but there's also something maybe unnerving.
It's almost like you happened upon these objects and they, and some network of connections in your mind sort of lit up and you're like, oh, that relates to this other thing that I might like to put in this still life.
Yeah, I think that the work, yeah, absolutely. The work, I think a lot of the work is almost like, I mean, there's a lot of, I'm very interested in literature. So I think a lot of the work is, it's narrative. The narrative is very open-ended, but it is. But I also think it's also kind of like a construction of a sentence, right? Like you have all these words and you put them together in a sentence and it has a meaning. Each word can have its own meaning, but together that transforms. And so I kind of think there's something here, very free association going on. It's very much kind of rooted in some type of psychology. And it's like you put these things together, full catastrophe living book, stack of coins, flowers, kind of this formal modernism backdrop. And it's like, that's a sentence. It means something. But not something so literal that I even can just tell you what that is here today. I think it's to me more open-ended.
It's really interesting to me that you talk about these pieces in terms of composing sentences. And I just wanted to, again, by way of description, just read some of the captions. So we have catastrophe, free will, film in parentheses, the grit of sleep, tomatoes with three S's, the hourglass, and the whisper. And these really intrigue me because I write poetry and they're operating poetically. The captions in themselves operate poetically and also in their relation to the images. And I see the construction of these pieces as very syntactical. And it's interesting to me because captions are normally meant to be explanatory, and in your images, the open-endedness of the word really encourages the viewer to see that language isn't as straightforward as or succinct as it claims to be.
Right. There's something maybe also, I think, a little from a contemporary art perspective. There's something kind of a bit humorous or contrarian in me putting the titles in the work. It's right. Kind of almost like there's like this joke of like, you're not really living in the present if you're signing the front of your paintings. You know, someone today would normally sign the back, go back 200 years, and, you know, Van Gogh's, as far as I recall, would be like signed the front. So there's this thing where you kind of remove a little of that narrative, that text, and it becomes this purely, in the world we live in today, like a visual work is purely visual. So I think there's also this kind of everything that you're saying is point on, and kind of for me also signed it kind of something a little sarcastic about like the title isn't something you read on a checklist. It's like there in your face, but it's still a visual work, but the title is so present.
Yeah, it seems to be like playing with the idea of instructing the viewer how to view it. But that seems very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, and I think that also it kind of adds to the works are very formal. You know, there's 50 works in the series, and as I mentioned, they're all shot in front of the same window. I put different colored paper backdrops and build in front of that and build the set in front of that. And I think that the formalism and having the title in there is also, I feel, very formal. It's kind of the evolution of my work. I think that my work used to be very chaotic, and maybe as I get a little older, my mind quiets down a little, so my work goes in sync with that. It's interesting to me because I look at artists I admire from a generation or two ago, and I see that their work, many artists' work, goes from like a point of like less formal to more. It seems to be some type of evolution. And so I see that in this work, too, that the work kind of becomes very formal. There's a chaos, but it's maybe not, it's more implied. It's more in the narrative, but kind of the work is a bit formal. And then having this big block title above is also very formal.
Looking at this series that's, has the strong linguistic element, it makes me think about your practice as a writer, because I know that you have written pieces to accompany your work. And I'm interested in whether or not you feel that sometimes the visual image doesn't do enough on its own, or are words needed to make for a fuller experience of the visual work?
It's a great question because, I probably spend more time currently reading than I do looking at art, especially being upstate. There's art institutions, but of course not like when I lived in New York City. And reading is so accessible. So I spend a lot of time reading. It's something I'm drawn to. And as you had mentioned, I have written essays for publications. I've written alongside my work. And I think that it's interesting because, they're in many ways, they're opposites. I feel that visual work often, to a degree, should stand on its own visually. Not everyone believes that. A lot of work requires a lot of context. But I think for me, and my work actually, there's a need for some context, but I think it also can stand visually, meaning you can hopefully look at it even if you don't know the context. If you looked at these works and didn't know I dug them up, the objects out of the ground, they still have some meaning and some purpose. So, there's this emphasis of like, I think a visual work to some degree to kind of be like beyond language. I don't know if that's the best description. Yeah. Separate from language, separate from narrative, from context. And for me, and I don't know, I wouldn't call myself a writer, so you can probably speak to this better, but I would often think like writing, especially, you know, fictional or narrative writing, it's all about this context. I mean, there's a story, maybe with poetry gets maybe a little closer to like how visual art exists.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say I love reading like narrative fiction. And I would say that's kind of like, in some ways, to me, the opposite of, say, a still visual image, which is kind of immediate. You know, if I'm going to read a book and it's 500 pages, there's also a narrative of me taking the time to read it. An image is immediate. So, you know, I don't know. I'm very interested in writing. Maybe in another world, I wished I were a writer.
Hmm.
But I became a visual artist early on. And by early on, I mean at like 12 and 13, I was making home movies with my grandmother. And they were incredible. And I would write. I thought I was going to be the next Quentin Tarantino. So I would write scripts and give them to my grandmother, and we'd act them. So I think I was working very narrative, almost kind of more related to language and literature and narrative and writing. Then my work, I think it's influenced by writing, but it's also there's also a big difference there.
Hmm. When you were talking about the question of whether a visual work can stand on its own, or you're feeling that it should be able to, and then the writing is just another mode that is a useful mode of expression that can work alongside the work. I'm remembering the time when I was writing reviews for Art in America, and I mean, I was pretty naive about art at the time, which is odd because I was writing reviews for Art in America. And I wrote in a review, like, my criticism was that this work wasn't interesting on its own without the wall text or without whatever language was presented alongside it. And the editor was arguing with me over that. And she said, like, can't a concept be beautiful or elegant, something along those lines. That was interesting to me, but still I was left with this question of, but I'm not getting the concept from the work, it's from the text about the work.
I do like this kind of argument for like context and contextualization. I haven't really ever heard that, and I like that because it's also not where I normally stand in relation to my work, but, you know, I know there's like many different ways in which to produce artwork, and much work that is all just about context, and all the meaning exists, or most of the meaning exists outside of the work. I mean, I think of like a lot of political art that's made today requires all this context for the work to have meaning. I feel that when the work is so contextual, it takes away that emotional impact of like, you know, and then of an immediacy of an artwork. But when I say that, I sound like I just teleported to 1945 and like modernism is ruling the world, because this is like, you know, there's this famous art critic, Clement Greenberg.
Yeah.
And he, you know, wrote a lot about the mid-20th century. And he would enter an artist's studio, and he would ask the artist to cover their painting. It would be like, let's say, like a, I don't know, a Jackson Pollock.
Mm-hmm.
And then the artist would uncover the painting, and his back would be to the painting. And he would immediately turn around, and then he sees the painting.
Yeah.
And it's like, he didn't walk in and put down his coat and see it. He just like, there it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is like high modernism, so I'm also a bit cautious of that, because that's a long way from today.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I think it's also, you know, like the ability to have an immediate emotional response to a work, in a sense, it also depends on the context, because I might have an immediate emotional response to a painting that somebody with a totally different background and history than me might have.
Mm, absolutely, yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a funny question because...
Poetry, I'm sorry, I was gonna say poetry maybe has more of this immediacy, you know, that art has, often has. You know, like a poem, you can just kind of immediately get lost and have a response to those words. But I think about, like, if I were to read a work of fiction, I've never read like two sentences of a 500 page book and that said, like, I love this book. You know, like, I don't have an opinion.
Yeah.
I could imagine having that kind of response maybe to a poem. But I do think art, visual art, opens the possibility for that immediacy, too.
Yeah. And I think, like, there is... That is my interest in poetry. Or what the work that I'm most drawn to is... It's like these small... units of language that are very much packed with meaning and multiple dimensions in the same way that a visual image can be.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I'm talking with Catskills-based artist Brian Zanisnik. Your current photo series has echoes of an earlier work you did, which was based on your exploration of the meadowlands in New Jersey. Both projects are very place-based and play with the complicated natural history of places that have had heavy intervention by human hands. So I'm wondering if you can describe the research you did in the Meadowlands and how it materialized into a piece.
The Meadowlands, I guess, is a lifelong fascination of mine. For those that aren't really familiar, there's a Meadowlands sports stadium in New Jersey. A lot of people know that's in the Meadowlands, which is a 32 square mile swamp, or you could maybe use the term wasteland, or now today maybe... development, because there's a lot of development happening in it. But basically, it's a landscape that's kind of been, for most of the 20th and into the early 21st century, just neglected. There were a lot of garbage dumps there. Many people know it from popular culture that if you watch any decent mafia movie and they're getting rid of a body, it's always the Meadowlands. So if you watch The Sopranos, it's the Meadowlands. If you watch The Godfather and they go to a swamp, and this is maybe a bit of like a cliche, but there's probably some truth in it. And it was this kind of this area that existed in New Jersey that was kind of at the margins of maps. So I grew up in New Jersey. Meadowlands was probably maybe 30 minutes from where I grew up. And the towns that are around it are these towns like Kearney, the town of Sea Caucus, which are actually in the middle of the Meadowlands. They're all intensely, densely populated. But then when you get to the edges of them and the swampland begins, it just kind of falls off into nothingness. And in the 20th century, there was a lot of attempts to develop it, but buildings would start sinking. So those were kind of... they gave up on those developments. And now, interestingly, there was a 20-year construction of one of the largest malls in the world. And that started in, I think, around 2004. And it only opened like a year or two ago because it was sinking. So they had to keep on finding new ways to develop it and to build it. And now it's finally open. So that's the area is really starting to change. I think new technology is... they're able with new technology to build better than before on swampland. But I was really drawn to it because it was kind of this blank spot on a map. I would go out there and start photographing it. There were a lot of objects out there that were dumped both legally and illegally. For example, when the original Penn Station was demolished in the late 1960s or early 1970s, they drove all the... rubble from it and dumped it in the Meadowlands, and there were a lot of kind of incredible neoclassical sculptures that were just dumped out there, and a long history of people searching the swamp for these to kind of claim them. So basically the landscape is full of objects, and I was out there photographing it, kind of researching and documenting that history. I remember I began this project almost 20 years ago, and this was after 9/11, and I would be out there, and occasionally there would be I would run into police or Homeland Security, and they would say, like, you need to leave, you're not allowed to be here. And I would be like, oh, is this private land, is this trespassing? Because there's no signs, there's nothing. And I remember one time I ran to a police officer in an SUV just driving these old kind of utility roads through the swamp, and he said, I don't know what the hell this is. I don't know if it's public, private, if there's infrastructure or not. I'm just told to keep people out. So I love this idea that even the authorities don't know what this place is. And I was mapping it. I was photographing the objects. A lot of those works were being also included kind of text, sort of maps with keys, and the map keys kind of had text suggesting things that were either really there or kind of I imagined to be there. And one of the things I love about this landscape is that it was not only is New Jersey so densely populated, it was right outside of New York City. And strangely enough, it's 32 square miles, roughly, the Meadowlands, which is about the square mileage size of Manhattan. So the two were almost like mirrors of each other. And if you want to get really poetic, this idea of, like, you know, the Manhattan is this city of buildings rising, you know, stories and stories into the sky, but the Meadowlands was actually stories and stories beneath the ground of clay, and that's why it was kind of so much anything put out there would sink. So it was this weird sort of mirror, or even I would say inversion of Manhattan. You know, one is so full of people, the other is devoid of it. And I spent a long time exploring it, photographing it, probably exposing myself to a lot of toxins I shouldn't have, but it's been a long time and I never got sick, so I'm great, grateful for that. But the area is famous for a lot of also chemicals, things being dumped out there. Now not so much. There's a lot of change happening there.
And one expression of your research there was a site-specific installation with performance elements, right?
Yeah, so I did a piece. It was titled Meadowlands Picaresque, and it was exhibited in a few places, most notably at the Brooklyn Museum in the city. And I began by having kind of the walls covered in photographs. It was actually, while I was out there one day, I saw a factory that was on fire, and I was photographing that. And so the walls kind of these these photographs of the Meadowlands, and also kind of these fires happening there. And then from that, I would kind of build out and place different objects that I had pulled from the Meadowlands, constructed in my studio, things that I even had found on the street. And so it's sort of how we were describing the photograph. The installation sort of worked like this too. It was kind of this multiple enigmatic narratives coming together. And then I did a sort of still life performance in it, where this was also part of a lot of work I had done for a number of years. I had done performances in collaboration with my parents, which was very interesting because my parents are not artists, but they were somehow on board with this collaboration. And we had done over, in the end, several hundred performances over a 10-year period. So it was a pretty in-depth project. And in this one in particular, in this sort of Meadowlands, entropic, collapsing, overwhelming environment of objects and photos, I was, my mother would be sitting on a lawn chair, so as if she was relaxing in her backyard, but she's kind of in this installation, and she's reading. And my dad was wearing this camouflage suit, and I had a bunch of these reeds, these invasive species of reeds that grow in the Meadowlands. I brought them and put them in the installation, and he was kind of hidden in them in this camo suit, so you actually couldn't really see him. And then I was standing in this kind of garden cage, and I had this pellet gun, and it was dangling above my hands, so it was like as if I was holding it, but my hands weren't touching it. And so it's kind of like a hunt. I think a lot of my work also is very interested in these cliche American tableaus. So this was like a hunting tableau, and my dad's in camo, and I'm kind of hunting, and my mom's just kind of relaxing. But you're also like, I mean, if you follow through in the narrative, you're like hunting in this wasteland of chemicals and pollution and nothingness.
So was there a lot of movement in the, like, were you all mostly still?
It was mostly still. That performance would happen, I think that one was 2 hours. And as with most of my works from that body of work, the performance would happen every Saturday for the run of the show. So I think that, you know, a show like that that's up for 3 months probably had 11, 12 performances. And the idea is we were like a tableau vivant.
Mm-hmm.
We were just frozen objects. And I would think of it like, you know, we were all just three more sculptures within all these other sculptures, or three more objects within all these other objects.
Right.
And the idea was kind of like, I had these ideas about the work and its meaning, and I thought of our bodies as more of material, meaning like the ideas would kind of, or these kind of filters for my ideas, the idea would kind of flow through our bodies, and just like there was maybe a photograph on the wall or a piece of trash I found in the Meadowlands, were just kind of more objects. Of course there'd be movement, but it would be like the blink of an eye,
right,
or the shift of a hand. And so those movements become very heightened. I would always remember when I would do these performances, my father's incredibly good at standing still. I guess that's a skill he didn't know he had, but he's like amazing at it. People would always look at him and say, that's a wax figure. And there's also something surreal, because the fact that we're not moving, that we're kind of surrounded, almost buried with objects around us, people sort of disassociate that we're there. So I once had commented to someone that it felt like I'm at my own funeral, because people would come in and say, oh, there's Brian. And,
yeah,
you know, they would talk about me, but they're not in front of me, but not to me. And people would always say, but his father is a wax figure.
Huh.
So there is something where there is a stillness, but then people would be saying, no, I think I saw it blink.
I really love tableau vivants, and I really appreciate that you created your own version of that. There's definitely times when I've just fallen into a Google rabbit hole looking at old photographs of tableau vivants.
And where would the one be? Like, I'm trying to think, like, would it be like, I'm trying to think, in America there might be in the past a tableau vivant at like the county fair or something, or a theater, like where
would
yeah,
but I also think rich people would have them at their parties.
There you go. Yeah, that's that absolutely. Yeah. There's something, which I think this also relates back to the photographs we spoke about earlier. There's something a bit kind of if not cliche, just kind of like cheesy about this idea. And I love kind of bringing that into the work and trying to refine that, because, you know, like I picture, I think you're absolutely right. Like, this is like a rich person's, you know, entertainment at their party. I picture, and I think there were these scenarios where it would be like a hundred year ago, county fair.
Yeah.
And there would be like a,
right,
or maybe like a nativity scene or something.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of this Americana that's almost like, bad taste. And I love that idea of taking that and seeing how I could bring that or filter that into a contemporary work.
Yeah, and also, like the series that we were talking about before, there's that, it's a 3D experience, but the idea of the tableau vivant is like try to look as much like a painting as you can. And so there's still that, almost that flattening. And I'm also, it's hard to verbalize without having an image to show what this installation really looks like. And there's this incredible density to it. It looks, from the images that I saw, like if you step away from it, the installation, all the different objects which are arranged from floor to ceiling are so dense that dimensionality is pretty weird. Does that describe it?
I think so. You know, I think that there's maybe a parallel there between like the flattening of the work and the flattening in the photographs. And I think that's why, you know, I work in all these different mediums. If I had to say, if someone said like you could only choose one that you are, I'd probably say a sculptor, because material kind of appears in all my different parts of my practice. But I think that I'm really interested in this idea of space, of this flattening, and maybe in these earlier works with these installation, it's very chaotic. There's thousands and thousands of objects, but then the flattening kind of also makes it a bit formal. So I think there's also a conversation happening there. And I remember one of my favorite objects from that is there was in the Meadowlands, there's some Amtrak train lines that run through it. And there was I had found an old like operator's cabin that maybe once someone sat in, but now with technology, that wasn't necessary. And just strangely, they never cleaned it out. So it had everything down to bottles of wine from the 70s in it. But I found the old worker's drawings on the wall from his kid. And this is like my favorite.
Oh, that's so cool.
My favorite artist, because these drawings were, I mean, especially because this was like in the middle, I would say maybe at this point, 40-50 minute walk from anywhere that was developed. In a swamp with like nothing around, and then you find this old collapsed cabin, and there's all broken glass, and you know, actually surprisingly minimal graffiti because it's so remote, but it kind of feels a bit like haunted and uneasy walking in there. And then you have these drawings that are like by a child, but also maybe looks like it could be, you know, out of like a bad horror movie. So I love finding those, and then I photocopy them and put them throughout the installation.
As you said before, there's a narrative element in the installation, which is called Meadowlands Picaresque, which, so the narrative element is suggested in the title, which references a genre of the novel, and the installation is autobiographical because your parents are in it, but the story or your place in it or your actual experience of time gets all chewed up and regurgitated into fragments. And I'll say that kind of fragmented narrative is something that I see across many of your works. And so I'm wondering if you think that, or why do you think that the picture of your lived experience always ends up so fragmented and densely layered?
I would say a lot of these works, when I've described them before, I thought of them as an archive, but without an index. So like normally if you think, you know, if you go to a library, there's an index of all the books there and where they're located. So that index allows it to make sense and to be usable. And I think that when I was making and when I'm making many of these works, if it becomes too easy to index and to make sense of, then maybe it starts becoming more flat in its meaning, more one-dimensional, more maybe just not something that you can kind of get lost in. If it starts making too much sense, it maybe just falls a bit flat. And I also think it kind of maybe falls into something else. I've always, in my work, shied away from the overt political because I feel like I am a very politically minded person, but I feel the art and art world is for me the last place to explore that. So I think that if a work sort of becomes more of like this archive with an index and it's logical and makes sense, it almost starts delving into the realm of the political because it's like instructional and right. I don't know if that's answering it at all.
Yeah.
I'm trying to unpack that a little.
Definitely. I wonder if it's more accurate to your actual experience of the world, which, I mean, just how you describe your time in the Meadowlands and even your relationship to the objects that you discovered in your house in the Catskills is like almost like you follow these different points that catch your interest and they are interesting to you in their objecthood and you kind of get lost in the different shapes and meanings and histories. So that fragmentary density, it seems maybe to be reflective of how you experience the world.
I think that's true. I think that, you know, I think it's fair to say that I have at times a bit of a chaotic mind. And I think that maybe that's how it comes across in my work. But it's like, I notice as my work and my life has progressed, maybe the chaoticness in my mind has slowed down. And I kind of joke about that, but I think it's interesting because I was saying earlier, I look at artists from a generation or two ago and see how their work has evolved. And one artist that comes to mind is this artist Chris Burden, who was known very early in his career for very visceral performances. He did very famously a piece where he literally crucified himself to a Volkswagen car. And he had a number of other very visceral performances like that. And I remember he's passed away now, but I remember later in his career, when I was a grad student in New York, I saw one of his shows and he was building model bridges, which I loved, but I thought Chris Burden was like, he once had someone shoot him in a gallery with an actual gun. And now 40 years later, he's building like beautiful, formal, ornate bridges. Like he would pick a bridge in the world and make a miniature of it. And it was just exquisite. And I thought like, you know, there's the kind of cynical, sarcastic side of me. And I'll say like, oh yeah, he's too old to get shot in the arm. Like you can't be like 70 and do that. It's too dangerous. You know, he did that when he was 20. But also there's just like the evolution. I don't know. I'm not obviously inside his head, but like maybe he also was no longer in that kind of angst of his youth. And he's kind of evolved and the work evolved and the work became more formal. But I see a little of that in my own process. Like I would say my photographs today are more formal than my work 10 or especially 20 years ago. And so maybe there's a little more room for quietness. But I would say especially with some of these installations, it's maybe really a lot of chaos. And it's partially how my mind thinks, but also it's also maybe goes back to that conversation about language and literature, because I think if the narrative isn't so fragmented, it starts delving also more, because my work is very narrative, almost into literature. And then I would ask the question, like, why am I not just a writer?
Right.
So, but again, it's interesting because poetry does some of the things that I think are more fragmented. So it brings the work maybe more in conversation with that.
I see something dark and a little bit scary in the mythology around Meadowlands Picaresque. The fact that it emerged out of your exploration of a wasteland built on trash, and also the mythology about, you know, the mafia dumping their bodies there. And you use the word sinister to describe your current photo series based on the Catskills. Thinking about these two works, I realize they're both, the Catskills and New Jersey are both regions that are orbiting New York City, which is this center of global culture and capital, but, you know, they're not New York City. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, they both become these receptacles for what the city doesn't want or like serving the city in some way. I know there's like the history of the reservoirs and the Catskills just like funneling all these natural resources away from the region and to New York City. And just thinking about that word sinister that you used, I'm wondering if you see something sinister on the horizon for these two regions, or is there some degree of apprehension that you feel when thinking about the future of these places?
I mean, I think like there's obviously some, you know, concern about the impact global warming will have on these places.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because I feel that the Catskills and the Meadowlands, for all their similarities, are also very different, especially in relation to this idea of the sinister. I see the Meadowlands as something that will be developed, and basically and it already is being, but now there's an attempt to develop it and populate it more than ever. And I think that has to do with, especially its proximity to Manhattan. I think that if you leave on a train from Manhattan, you could be in the Meadowlands in 5-10 minutes. So it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario where developers wouldn't want to claim this space and try to use it and build, you know, infrastructure, housing, everything. The Meadowlands, the Catskills is a little different because, as you mentioned, the water from New York City is in the Catskills, and in fact, where I live is in the New York City watershed. So I thought I was leaving New York City, but I'll drive 5 minutes from my home and see an NYPD car because they actually are patrolling the area. It's interesting because they need this resource. There's, as you mentioned, the controversy of it kind of belonging here but traveling to the city. But I think that the area is relatively protected as far as from pollution, overdevelopment, because of this resource and the need for it. So there's a part of me that almost thought when I moved here, like, what a beautiful, pristine place. But I think, like, where's the edge? And where's the cynicism? Because it's almost like, even though there's some, maybe, you know, something sinister about taking this resource, it's very different. If I went for a 1 mile walk in the Meadowlands, I would see a lot of, I remember there were signs in the Meadowlands that said, you know, do not fish here. If you arrived at the spot, the fish will give you cancer. And I think, like, that's so specific. I've never seen such a warning.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's specifically heat. Like, it's not saying, like, could. You're just saying, like, this is so dangerous. And I would say, like, you know, the river, the Schoharie Creek that's near my house, I know that I can drink from it because it's very pristine water. So there's something maybe actually a bit optimistic about that. There's something also maybe challenging for me and to think about how I will make work and do make work in the Catskills, because it's not such a fragmented place. And you had used the word fragmented to describe a lot of my work, and I think that's absolutely accurate in describing the narratives. I think the Meadowlands is very fragmented, right? It's like a wasteland, a garbage dump. There's bodies there. There's the largest mall in, I think, or the second largest mall in America there. So it's like all these fragments, right? It's incredibly polluted, but lots of people want to live there now because of its proximity to the city. Catskills, and maybe over time I will find more fragments, but it doesn't have so much of that. It has a bit of a singular narrative. You know, a lot of the land is protected, especially within the lines of the park, is protected. And so I think in making work here, I need to sort of approach it in a different way. There's some optimism for a change.
Yeah, that's good.
I wouldn't deny all the concerns we have about global warming and everything, but I feel that maybe we're here as susceptible to that as, say, other places in the state or...
Yeah, and thinking about the potential, like... disastrous outcomes of the changing climate, I also think about the human-made disasters that have happened. And in talking about the Catskills functioning as the source of water for the city, there's this history of whole towns being intentionally flooded in order to replace them with reservoirs.
Right.
And it's like an act of God, but the God is the metropolis.
Well, so that's, I mean, so you obviously, yeah, if you dig anywhere, you can always find this sort of sinister narrative, and that's a perfect example of it. But I think it's interesting because in the town I live, I can't tell you the exact percent, but more of the town is owned by New York City than anything else. And actually, Greene County is trying to stop New York City from buying land because they buy so much land that they don't develop, they don't do anything, they just want to own as much as possible to protect the watershed and the water supply. And one of the benefits to that is there's so much just natural land, you know, that is just available for hiking, fishing, just for use. But the downside to that is that it also makes there almost no ability for, I mean, it's not even a risk of overdevelopment. There's a lack of amenities because the areas are so owned by the city that there's not much can be even put there.
That's interesting.
I know that Greene County is trying to stop, or it maybe even did stop, the city from purchasing more land, because now I think they own they're the largest landowner in the county. But then it's like some people say, like, you know, but we also would like our town to have a restaurant.
Right.
So there's this kind of, you know, push and pull. And I know that there's an old, we had spoken about this earlier, there's an old hotel in Lexington, New York. It's incredible building. It's from the 1800s. And it went to someone who wants to restore it. But before that person purchased it, New York City wanted to buy it so they can just bulldoze the building and make it just land. So there's, like, you know, great about all the nature, but there's also kind of this balancing act with the fact that people live here.
We are about out of time. And to close the show, I just wanted to ask you where people can learn more about your work.
Sure. So you can go to my website, which is just mylastname.com, Zanisnik, ZANISNIK.com, or to my Instagram, which is under my name, Brian Zanisnik. Those are probably the best places to see my work online.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for talking with me today. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm sorry.
Thank you.